Ladies and gentlemen, we have six cases on the calendar this morning. Three patent cases, a case from the Court of International Trade, and two cases from the Court of Federal Claims, which are pro se and being submitted on the briefs and will therefore not be argued. Our first case is Mondis Technology versus Innolux and Honhai Precision, 2013-11-78. Mr. Weed, is it?
Yes.
Please proceed.
May it please the Court, Peter Weed for Honhai Precision Industry. The District Court improperly enhanced the ongoing royalty rate in this case after conducting a willfulness analysis. Honhai sought to correct this error by its Rule 60B motion, which the District Court denied, and therefore this appeal followed. The District Court erred in its enhancement because enhancement is a punitive measure, while an ongoing royalty should be compensatory.
Well, if we conclude that Innolux waived that argument below, is it your view that your client is not bound by the waiver below and he can raise that here, or is that a problem for you?
I would first disagree that Innolux waived it, but secondly, I would say that Honhai is not bound by that because they were not a party to the underlying litigation where the ongoing royalty was set, and that's made clear in the District Court's order at JA5149, where it specifically said only Mondis and Innolux would be parties to that case. So to apply a waiver to a party, to Honhai, which was not a party to that case, had no knowledge of what was going on in that case, I think would be inequitable.
Go ahead. That's true even though the successor and assigns are bound? You're not disputing that, and therefore even if the successors and assigns are bound, you say that they get to relitigate all of the substantive legal issues?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that they get to relitigate all the substantive issues. However, if that initial decision was in error and was inequitable and did not follow the principles of equity, then I believe a successor and assign can.
Even if that argument was never made below? And the District Court didn't have the benefit of any of that argument, the party didn't raise it?
Yes, certainly. I believe this court can still correct that decision, even if it wasn't raised below. For example, in the Interactive Gift Express case, the court went through the various factors that might lead this court to consider an issue, even if it weren't raised below. And again, I do believe it was, and it was certainly raised by Honhai below. So the District Court, in deciding the Rule 60B motion, or denying Honhai's Rule 60B motion, had the benefit of that argument.
How is it supposed to work? And I guess why should we not worry about this? The general risk that a defendant loses on an issue, or maybe waives the issue, I'm not sure it makes any difference, sells its assets, its business, its operating business, to a company that maybe it's just created. We now have a successor in interest, and the successor in interest was obviously not originally a party. The successor in interest gets to relitigate issues that could have been or even were litigated by the original party? What kind of precedent? I understand that everybody, including the original party, can make arguments that circumstances have changed under 60B, but that's not, with one exception, the argument you're making. So how is it that a successor in interest is not very broadly bound by the resolution or waiver of any issue that was litigated or could have been litigated on the circumstances at the time?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important to look at the specific circumstances of this case. I agree there may be cases in which it would certainly make sense for a successor in interest to be bound. In this case, Honhai didn't purchase the entire business. It purchased only some of the assets.
But you have conceded that you were a successor in interest with a full stop, period. I assume, therefore, any rules that apply to successors in interest with respect to standing in the shoes of their predecessor apply to you.
I would also point out that...
Is that a yes to Judge Toronto's comment?
I'm not sure I could say yes to all rules. And in particular, what I think makes this a little bit different is that at the time Hohenheim admitted or decided not to contest being the successor and raised these issues before the district court, the Inalux was still appealing and did still have these issues were still open before this court. So this is not a case where you have a party that has lost before this court, then decides to...
But when you're buying whatever it was that you bought that now by concession made you a successor in interest, you were buying under whatever agreements you had with Inalux to either bind them to pursue the issues that they were at that moment still pursuing or not to settle them or whatever. I mean, that's... that's, you know, you took whatever risk you there was that Inalux could do with the litigation what it in fact did with the litigation.
I think that might be a correct statement, Your Honor. If it were a situation where the purchaser had reason to believe that they would be a successor and therefore be bound by that decision, if you look at the timeline in this case, the there was not a court order that bound successors and assigns until April 30th. That was after Hohenheim had purchased whatever assets it had purchased from Inalux and had entered the market. So under these circumstances, I think it's unreasonable to, in hindsight, say Hohenheim should have known that there would eventually be this order that it might be bound by and that therefore should have proceeded accordingly and protected itself in its arrangements with Inalux.
Is it your argument not just that waiver should necessarily apply in those sorts of things, but that your client, because he's a successor and didn't actually do it, have hands-on below, that you should not be bound by the finding of willfulness based on something like copying? I mean, obviously you weren't in the room when that happened since you were the successor. Is it your view that you should not be bound because of that to any previous willfulness finding?
We do make the argument, Your Honor, that willfulness analysis has to be done on an individual basis because it goes to the party's state of mind, intent, and culpability. And so I do believe in a successor, and particularly under these circumstances, it would be inappropriate to carry over that willfulness assessment.
Do you have any cases to support that proposition?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any cases. This is, I believe, a somewhat a unique circumstance in terms of the way that both the litigation and the business activities have played out. Moving on with the substantive issue, namely willfulness, and in particular the issue of enhancement, which I think is an important distinction to make, that willfulness and enhancement are two separate issues.
So in your view, if the district court had considered the willfulness or just the fact that they've already lost, you've already prevailed on the case, and if you go into court, you might get a willfulness or tripling of damages, would that appropriately be part of Georgia's specific factors? Is it just the problem to do it under Reed versus Georgia Pacific, or are you suggesting that that cannot be a consideration at all?
I would suggest that enhancement would not be a consideration at all, because that enhancement, as this court has said in Whitserv and Centonics, serves solely a punitive purpose, and in setting an ongoing royalty, and in particular if you're using the Georgia Pacific factors, that is only intended to be compensatory.
But could you not consider it as a factor in the analysis of whether or not this is compensatory?
Certainly Mondes makes that argument. I don't believe that a party would necessarily be facing enhancement in a second litigation where you have a situation where a court has said that a patentee is not entitled to absolutely exclude the party, that particular party, from practicing the invention, but is only entitled to compensation for
the
use of it.
That was a very odd argument, I must say. I wasn't buying it at all, so I guess I might ask you, since you've made it again, whether you have any cases to cite for that proposition, that they wouldn't use any willfulness component in the subsequent litigation because they would just look at the fact that, well, the district court didn't impose a permanent injunction. Really?
I would point, Your Honor, to the lower court opinion in the active video case in which the district court said willfulness would be improper to consider because the party is acting under a court order or essentially with the benefit of the court saying you can continue this activity provided you pay this what the court has determined to be a reasonable royalty.
Might it make a difference what the reason is that a district court in a particular case decides not to issue a conduct stopping injunction? If it's a case in which the conduct, for example, it's infringing but it's it is the supplying of a medical product that nobody else is supplying, including the patentee, and for which there are no good substitutes, then the district court can say, it would be positively harmful for you to stop this. Please don't. I won't make you stop. And then the ongoing royalty would just be market value. But if the reason is one of the first two, essentially the same factors of eBay, money is good enough, that doesn't place a kind of imprimatur on the please continue it. It's just you can if you want, but that's just because the plaintiff can be made whole in damages.
Yes, Your Honor, I think it does, and I think that would go not necessarily to whether willfulness should be considered, but it will go to the changed circumstances of the party. And so, for example, in the Bard case, where you did have competitors making a medical device, and that was part of the court's consideration for not imposing the injunction in that case, the court did take into consideration the fact that that you would otherwise have competitors, you had lost profits, and so there was a change in the party situation, and therefore a royalty higher than the one awarded by the jury was appropriate. In situations where I think it's the first two factors, say, and in this case where you solely have a licensing entity, there's not going to necessarily be a change in the relationship of the parties, or in this case, not a substantial change pre-litigation versus post-litigation, and therefore you would have less of a factor or less of a change in the royalty rate. In either situation, though, I don't think willfulness and, in particular, the Reed factors are the appropriate way to approach it.
Mr. Weed, you wanted to save some time. You have about 2.5 minutes left.
I'd like to reserve it if the court has no further questions.
We will do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Black.
Thank you. May it please the court. This case was tried to the jury in June of 2011. Hi-Hi was at the trial and settled on a Sunday before the jury came back on Monday morning.
But that was with respect to the televisions, right?
That was with respect to the televisions. That is correct.
Can I ask you, I mean, I know abusive discretion is the standard here, correct?
Yes, sir.
And it's quite a deferential standard, but how are we to apply an abusive discretion review when the district court here didn't give us any reasons?
Sure, Your Honor. Well, the district court did provide reasons for the underlying judgment. There was a lengthy opinion with respect to how the Georgia-Pacific factors and the Reed factors were applied by Judge Ward, which was issued on September 30th, 2011. There was also a lengthy opinion that went along with the final judgment stating why the district court was making the judgment binding on successors and assigns, which was an issue that had been litigated. So the district court's reasons for the underlying legal decisions that were made in the case were spelled out in those decisions.
So we shouldn't rely on other things. I thought you were arguing, maybe I'm not right, that there were other reasons that he did not abuse his discretion, the timing, the time lapse, and so forth. So So you're telling us now that we should not rely on those. We should rely exclusively.
Your Honor, all I'm saying is that there are the judge did state reasons for the underlying issues which Hanhai is raising now with respect to Georgia-Pacific and Reed, which is the thrust of the appeal here. With respect to the Rule 60B decision, the judge did not issue a separate decision. We had oral argument on the contempt motion in relation to Hanhai's conduct and the 60B motion on the same day, and the judge issued a summary decision denying it. The case law says that the court can uphold the judgment on any basis that's in the record. We think that the legal bases that Hanhai has argued to the court are erroneous in and of themselves, and the decision explains why. But there are additional reasons why the district court acted within its discretion in refusing the 60B application. First of all, in order to bring a motion under Rule 60B, the movement has to show diligence. That's very clear. Here, the decision which they're challenging is really the September 30th, 2011 ongoing royalties order. They waited 9 months to challenge that, and when they did challenge it, it was only after we had filed a contempt motion, after having caught them, and they put up their hands and they say, okay, we give up, we are the successors. That's not the kind of diligence which is contemplated by Rule 60B. Hanhai was not a stranger to these proceedings. They were following the case closely. They had multiple board members on the Intelux board, and they were cooperating with Intelux throughout the process. It's very clear that they made a conscious decision not to participate in the litigation, not to admit that they were successors, and to hope that either Intelux would defeat the judgment, or that they would litigate for years, or that we would give up, or something would happen, but it didn't work out that way. And so they didn't file a direct appeal, and instead what they did is they filed a Rule 60B motion. In order to prevail on that, they have to first show diligence. Then they have to meet one of the...
Could they have filed a direct appeal, and if so, by what procedural mechanism?
I believe they could have, Your Honor. In Closter Steel, which was a case involving successors and assigns, the court said that the successor, having been bound by the judgment, when the judgment was issued, injunction was issued in that case, it said successors are bound. The court said that the successors, as parties in interest being bound by the injunction, could have appealed, even though they weren't parties to the case. They also could have formally intervened. The procedure here was a little odd. They were in the case, then the judge gave a different docket number to the ongoing royalties case, and we went forward. But if they had wanted to challenge the royalty rate when they knew that they were buying the business, as Your Honor pointed out, they certainly knew what was going on, they could have come back into the case. They never actually filed a formal intervention motion at all in this case. They just reappeared, and here we are. So they certainly had time to re-enter the litigation, make any points that they wanted to make, and take a direct appeal. And had they done that, when I was here before two of your honors, on the appeal with Intelux, we would have had these issues all vetted and resolved. But they didn't do that. And so now we're here on 60B. And on 60B, they have to point to one section of the rule, and they have to establish the legal right to relief. Under 60B1, they are proceeding under the stake section of 60B1. Which requires, under the Fifth Circuit law, a fundamental error, more than an arguable point of law, something that's fundamental. They simply can't meet that burden. Under Rule 60B-5, they have to show a change in the law or the facts, and neither of those have been sustained here. So for those reasons, we don't believe...
What about the obvious, error in law? I mean, are you defending the view that you can do this under Reed, willfulness, and then compound the damages, or are you suggesting an alternative?
We believe what the district court did was correct, and that any objection to that was waived. But what the district court did in this case was clearly correct under the law by assigning some measure of the damages to willfulness. There's been several cases in this court, including the Syncor case in March, the Bard case, and numerous district courts, all of which have considered willfulness in one way or another in evaluating ongoing royalties. It's certainly not, that is the right way to approach ongoing royalties, which in effect are really a substitute for having a second case. If you didn't have...
Can I just double check? I mean, has this court actually ruled on an issue about whether willfulness can play a role in the... specification of the amount of an ongoing royalty. My recollection is that was in fact not an issue in Bard.
In the Bard case, there was a Bard 1 and a Bard 2, and the district court case district court case issued an award of damages.
I know it was an issue in the district court. What I'm saying is I'm not remembering that it was an issue.
In footnote 1 of Bard 2, there's a statement that says that we uphold the ongoing royalty award and would do so even if willfulness had not been found in the original case. And the district court in that case had found willfulness going forward and awarded ongoing royalty damages. Also, in the...
Even if willfulness had not been found in the original case.
Correct.
Yeah, but that's a different question than I think Judge Toronto is focusing on. Even if there's no willfulness below, whether or not you oppose those damages in the future.
My understanding of the footnote was what the court was saying is the district court found that it would be willful going forward in order for them to infringe, and that assessed increased damages as a result. In Bard 2, in the footnote, the court said, we're reversing on a number of other grounds, but we're not upsetting the ongoing royalty award, which we would find appropriate in this case, even if there hadn't been any willfulness in the underlying action in the pre-verdict period. So the court was saying, even if there was no willfulness in the pre-verdict period, we'd accept a willfulness enhancement for the post-verdict period. Similarly, in the Syncor case, the court accepted for ongoing royalties before the entry of a permanent injunction that the damages could be enhanced. And in principle, there's no difference between royalties accruing in the post-verdict period through the entry of a permanent injunction barring sale and ongoing royalties through the life of the patent.
Can I ask you about one piece? Judge Ward had a paragraph about how the Innolux official, I don't know what level of official, made some remarks that Judge Ward thought were disrespectful of the patent system. Suppose I thought that was not a very sound basis for increasing an amount. What effect would that have here?
It wouldn't have any effect. Judge Ward stated in his opinion that he would have found he would have reached the same result, I believe. And I believe that he would have. But we can't challenge that now because the decision was made by Innolux to agree to this procedure, and the procedure was followed, and Judge Ward's view on that would be considered under the abuse of discretion standard before reaching a final judgment, and after a final judgment, it's effectively unreviewable.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Mr. Weed has about 2.5 minutes rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Starting with the Bard case, I think it's important to recognize if you look at the district court's opinion, there is no mention in the district court of the Reed v. Portek case, the Reed factors. There's no discussion of willfulness going forward. The court does say, yes, the party is voluntarily choosing to continue, but there's not an enhancement based on willfulness. The mere fact that the royalty rate that was set by the district court was higher does not mean that it was enhanced because of willfulness. So I don't think the Bard case stands for the proposition that a willfulness enhancement is appropriate in an ongoing royalty. Similarly, in the Syncor case quite clearly states at page 1385 of the opinion that what was at issue there was an award of damages under section 284 for the time period between the verdict and the imposition of the permanent injunction. So there's no question that under 284, the court has the authority to enhance a royalty amount. And so the Syncor case, again, provides no support or guidance for a willfulness enhancement in the context of an ongoing royalty. With regard to the alleged delay on the part of Honhai, again, I think it's important to consider the timeline here. You don't have an opinion saying that successors and assigns will be bound until April 30th. At that point, in April and in May, Mondes is still taking the position that Honhai is a new entrant. They said that to Honhai in correspondence. And on May 24th, three weeks and a few days after there's finally an order, they sued Honhai as a new entrant. So in retrospect, to say, well, Honhai should have known it was a successor, despite the fact that Mondes was taking the position, despite the fact that both Mondes and the district court, as Mondes admits on page 43 of their brief, knew all these facts but never tried to include Honhai as a named party in the court's order. To say that Honhai alone should have had should have known that it somehow should have been involved and that this may be an issue, I think is hindsight and an unfair imposition on Honhai. If the court has no further questions, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. We'll take the case under advisement.